Welcome to the Marketing Phoenix Podcast, where my guest and I will give you our best growth strategies for marketing that leads to sales. My name is Melissa Rogozinski, and I'll be your host.
This is our inaugural Phoenix interview, and I am tickled to have Mike Bryant, partner at Knox Capital, as our very first guest. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Melissa. Glad to be here.
So, Mike, before we get started into some of the questions and articles and things that we've written and discussed, would you mind telling our audience just a little bit about yourself and how you got into legal tech? Because everything that I have heard is that all roads in legal tech investment lead to Mike Bryant.
Well, the investment part of it is fairly recent in the scheme of things. My background is really more operating in the legal market, in business development roles, general management roles, corporate development roles, both upmarket in larger public companies initially. And then somewhere along the way, I really found that I enjoyed working with the early stage companies that in this case that we were buying and integrating into a bigger platform. And technology as well, really kind of enabling a big services company with technology. I was enthralled in both of those areas and then just jumped out when I left corporate, jumped into some startups, had some great experience there, and ultimately settled on the lower middle market is really the, if I had to define the asset class that Knox Capital invests in, beginning in 2017, that's how I would pigeonhole what we do. Knox Capital invests in legal and financial services oriented companies that are founder led in most cases. And in all cases, we're the first institutional money to come in. It's typically bootstrapped businesses that are looking for not only capital to grow, but some real operational insight and help in taking the business to the next level.
Well, that segues actually to our very first question. And it's about an article that you co-authored. And I saw in a post on LinkedIn where you put it out a few months ago. You made the article that you co-authored with Sales and Acquisitions in the Middle Market, and you made a comment in your LinkedIn post that 2023 will be about quality, not quantity of deal flow. What does that mean to you and other investors and prospects seeking capital investment?
Well, again, depending on what stage we're talking about, certainly I think the first shoe to drop was really the early stage. The venture activity was starting to slow down really as of last year. And it did feel like we're in a bit of a bubble as related to some of the valuations around SaaS companies. They needed to normalize. They did normalize. I think venture is looking for higher quality. I think existing portfolio companies inside of early stage funds, there's a real premium now on profitability and really demonstrating that the business model works. I would say lower middle market and middle market private equity, there is a real focus on quality of earnings, quality of cash flow, the durability of a business, especially if you're looking at a mix of equity and debt being leveraged as part of a transaction. And that, the debt market, because the debt markets have tightened up, it's pretty well documented. So it's really the quality deals it's in 23 that are getting done at every stage of the investment spectrum.
So as you said, a lot of capital just flowed freely into legal tech, especially in 21 and 22. And we've certainly seen that tightening this year. So an article that we wrote called What Legal Tech Startups Really Need, we address this of the capital flow. What makes legal tech such a dynamic and an exciting industry for investment?
It's still very fragmented in the scheme of things. There are a lot of opportunities, whether you're looking at, the end market being corporate legal departments or the end market being law firms, big law, mid law, small law, all of those segments there. There is still a lot of opportunities across each of those buyer sets. And I think that we're even seeing interest, institutional interest in areas that are traditionally not been looked at by professional investors. That is the plaintiff's bar, for instance. Mm-hmm. Consumer law, once dominated by LegalZoom, I think that there's segments inside of the consumer law space that entrepreneurs can take advantage of that, where you won't be crushed by the weight of a large lead gen engine like LegalZoom or a Rocket Lawyer. There are places to participate in the B2C space as well. And so there's plenty of opportunities. And I think investors will continue to seek out entrepreneurs that have a unique value proposition to attack those various segments.
And I'm going to kind of segue the interview that we prepared, because I was interviewed right after Legal Week. And before we started this interview, we were talking about, conferences in this industry that we both see that bring real value. And I completely agree with what you're saying. And one of the biggest things that I saw at Legal Week, I got asked twice, unofficially and officially, what was one of the biggest things I saw. I saw a level playing field at Legal Week. I saw a lot of younger companies and startups that I had not seen that kind of environment at Legal Week in years past that I've attended. It's usually been the big Goliaths, companies with big pockets. And I saw, and I was really excited to see it, a level playing field. And I feel it kind of piggybacks on what you were saying, that the consumers, whether they're law firms or consumers themselves, they don't always want an all-in-one solution. One size doesn't necessarily fit all. And they want to be able to put together the pieces the way they want to. And so seeing that landscape at Legal Week this year with more smaller companies and having a level playing field where I felt they actually had a real opportunity to compete for business and brand awareness at Legal Week. So I saw some of the same things. What would you say to that?
I think it's just it's a sign of a real healthy, mature, market mm-hmm. and real ecosystem. When you see technologists, entrepreneurs from outside of the legal space entering it, to be disruptive, and you see money that has not invested in legal traditionally entering it. And then also importantly, entrepreneurs that have been successful in legal, maybe had an exit, re-entering the same market and really finding an adjacency and finding an area to go solve a problem. So that to me is just all, those are real good data points around a healthy, continuing to grow marketplace.
So in another article we wrote, What Legal Tech Investors Really Want, we identified that about $6.5 billion was invested in specifically in legal tech back in 2021. What is an investor really looking for in order to determine that a legal tech company would be a good investment? And I know you mentioned profitability. That should be an obvious to everyone, but what else should investors be looking at? And should these companies be thinking at if they want investment from VC or PE?
Yeah, I think I think some of this holds true regardless of what stage an investor is entering the market at. I do think, the first things you look for is there a large addressable market? And I think that's a table stakes, you know, that's a box that's going to get checked virtually every time. I think if you're in a more mature segment, you know, for instance, I'll pick on e-discovery. It's an area that I know and love. I still think there's opportunities even within a very mature e-discovery market to find a niche, improve on it with a single point solution, whether you're a technology provider or a service provider. And then it really does come down to the team. It's a little bit overstated sometimes, but particularly what I like to see in a management team and founders in particular is ideally someone that has someone on the team or someone on the in their advisory orbit really knows this market well, because there are idiosyncrasies to legal and selling into legal. And I think to the extent that they've had an experience that is a larger experience running a bigger business and coming in to do something disruptive in a smaller context, I think having that upmarket experience, bringing it to a startup, if it is an early stage business, really is an advantage, because you know what excellence looks like, you know what scale looks like. Mm-hmm. And you'll surround yourself with the right team to get you to scale. So those are some of the things I look for in investments.
Yeah. And, you know, I did a buyer's prospectus a year ago for a conference that had a lot of investors and legal tech startups, and, you know, shared that with a few people who had kind of helped me with insight. And that's really one of the most amazing things, is to see really who are the, you know, who started the company, who's the sales and marketing, who are the founders, what kind of experience do they have? And there's a lot of great ideas, but if you don't really know this industry, it is such a dynamic industry, very intelligent, highly educated, ambitious professionals. And if you don't understand those idiosyncrasies, as you call it, you're going to have a difficult time communicating with the buyers and even knowing if you found a fit. You know, in some of the things I see is, we created this great technology because, you know, law is not as progressive or as slow. But if you don't understand why sometimes law seems slow to everybody outside of this industry, then you don't understand. It's not really slow. It's just that we're very methodical. We're very careful. We take our time. There are a lot of things and details in law that we need to dig into and investigate before we make a statement, before we write a letter, before we file a lawsuit, before we respond to anything. And so those are some of the idiosyncrasies that if you don't really understand how that works, you don't understand if you have a true product fit or how to communicate with the target buyer. So with a market range of anywhere from 18 million to 92 billion, which is what we found out when we did this buyer's prospectus, and it was an average, obviously legal tech investments can be quite lucrative. So what are the business functions? You kind of addressed this a little bit ago, but what are some of the business functions of legal tech companies that provide the most valuable information to an investor about its growth potential?
Well, I would say that, you know, first of all, in terms of that range, Knox Capital tends to participate at the lower end of that range. So let's call it an $18 million business. If it's a software company, you know, you would expect that software company to be operating at you know, 20% plus margin profile. And if it's a services company, it might be a slightly less, margin. But in all cases, we're looking for growth potential, both organic and inorganic. We often find there's two areas that require immediate investment in companies around that size. Call it anywhere from 10 million to 50 million in revenue. Mm-hmm. And that is typically they're subscale as it relates to finance and accounting, and really kind of having the systems and the talent to kind of deal with the scale that we're going to be looking at post-close, both in terms of the investments we'll make in the organic sales and marketing flywheel, but also add-ons. You know, that is the, it's a tried and true way to grow very quickly, to gain share, to expand into new markets, and to create shareholder value is through acquisitions, if they're the right acquisitions. And it's interesting, I know this is right up your alley, Rogo, is the typically and oftentimes founders will have real sales chops, but they haven't yet built out a real enterprise class sales and marketing engine. So we will typically need to lean in on that and work with partners like RPC, you know, bring talent in from a sales leadership standpoint, from a RevOps standpoint, you know, from a marketing perspective. So those are really the two areas that we see frequently require significant investment post-close.
So let's dive into a little bit more about that. Let's talk about marketing and sales strategies, because as we have, you and I met a couple of years ago because we were working for a technology company that you were involved with. And over the last 2 years, we've been talking about this need that there's lots of areas for due diligence before an investor makes a decision for a prospect or an acquisition. And, you know, when a company comes and says, okay, look, here's our revenue, and with your investment, this is where we believe we can get, there can be a gap there of that growth strategy. So what is it about marketing and sales strategies that are so important to an investor in order to help them make a good decision about an investment?
Well, I think first it's really having a clear and again, this is just sometimes a founder's mentality. They have such great instincts, and those instincts have taken them to this point. But we normally find that they're getting stuck at a certain size, and they're really extending their hand saying, "We need help." And I think the first thing that we need to do is kind of understand let's find a common destination that we want to get to. And I think looking anywhere beyond 2 to 3 years is challenging. So we try to anchor around that destination, and then really look at what investments that we can make now that they have a capital, ready access to capital. Where do we want to place our bets in terms of talent, in terms of targets to purchase, software to invest in, automation? You know, what will get us to that place in the most efficient manner? And once we have that destination and we start to build that map, you can just tell that there's a real relief on the part of the management team, because they know they've got a partner. They share a common vision, and then you're just really blocking and tackling and making sure that you're really putting the right initiatives and targets and measures in place to hold each other accountable to get there in a you know, capital efficient and time efficient way.
So identifying the right targets and making sure that you've got that, what we would call a tech stack in place, that when you're creating marketing messaging and content and putting it out there, that it's reaching the right intended audience. You've got your goal, but you have to reach the right intended audience, but then having the marketing tech stack in place and set up correctly so that the founder and investor can identify what's working, where we need improvement, and what's really driving us in a most efficient manner towards that goal. Correct?
Absolutely.
So let's talk about the big bank news that's been happening in the last couple of months. So obviously with SVP, Credit Suisse, First Republic, and a few others, It's caused a little bit of a shaky ground for entrepreneurs and investors. So what should legal tech startups really consider besides some of the basics? What should they be thinking about, and questions should they be asking when choosing the financial institution that really is right to help them manage their businesses' assets and help them grow? And I have some comments about that because I've done it myself. And it was a little bit of a struggle at first. So I know some of those struggles from a bootstrap point of view, but I really love for our audience to hear from you first.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's a little bit ironic that, you know, I think of the big commercial banks, the safest haven for money of any real magnitude is quite honestly the biggest of the big, only because like Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, only because they've been under such incredible scrutiny and monitoring since the 08 crisis. Mm-hmm. Their balance sheet has been getting tested for years now. So there was great visibility into what was happening at those large banks. The regionals really got sideways and caught a lot of people by surprise, some of the nichier regionals. And obviously SVB is beyond regional, but they're sort of classed that way at some level. I just think that at least the entrepreneurs that we work with, they're tending to work with banks that they've had relationships with a long time. And I do think it's a little bit of a barbell thing here where either you need to go up market for safety around, you know, really federally backed, institutions that, you know, where, you know, you can certainly distribute your deposits as well to kind of keep under, you know, the recoverable levels. I also, you know, think if you're down market, if you're more of an early stage business or a lower middle market business, I think relationships matter. I personally, you know, when I've run smaller businesses, I've tended to work with bankers that I know, I have longstanding relationships with. And, because when things go sideways, you just need to have more than being a, you know, kind of a number on a spreadsheet. So I think it's really curating the banking relationship based on your particular circumstance. Mm-hmm. But it's now, you know, much more. I think it's much more awareness around when you do have larger balances, you're going to need to take measures to distribute the cash across multiple institutions, unfortunately, at this time.
That makes sense. And I want to add too that, you know, as I've been building RPC, now I've been an entrepreneur in legal tech for 11 and a half years now. RPC is, you know, we just celebrated our fourth anniversary. So this isn't my first rodeo, but it was the first opportunity I had outside of also balancing some personal life challenges to just focus 100% of my time and energy and resources on the company. And I have found too that, you know, the banks want the same thing that are holding my assets. They want the same thing that the investors do. They want to see, first of all, that I've got the chops to stay the course, because starting a company is really difficult. You're considered a startup at least until you're seven, and the first 3 years are your hardest. So banks and investors want to see that you have the chops to stay that course and get past that really hard part. But the other thing, they wouldn't give me anything until I proved I could make money. And they wanted to see me making money and making deposits over a certain length of time before they would start opening up additional capital resources to me. And so, you know, we're certainly at that point now, but, you know, that was really frustrating to me, not only with my personal credit score, but building a business credit score. But certainly having that relationship with the bank, and it was frustrating, but at the same time, now that I am where we are now, you know, it's open to me and I don't mind being pushed back a little bit by my bank, to make sure I'm going to stay the course and prove the model that we've built and that we can, because that's what we want. That's what you all want. You want to see that we know how to grow this company through real, true, organic sales. You can't just grow through debt. You have to show organic growth and real sales. You've got to know what you're doing and who you're doing it for.
Well, that's right. There's a role they play, right? I mean, banks will require of entrepreneurs, they'll require personal guarantees unless you can really demonstrate to them that you've got recurrence in your revenue stream, right? Either it's recurring, it's repeatable, it's contractual. And then you can truly obtain cash flow type financing. So I think that's always a trick to companies as they grow is really showing that repeatability around their revenue streams.
I think for me, it was getting to the point that I didn't need it before they were willing to offer it.
Always. Yes.
And it actually makes sense, you know, managing the business. So, but I appreciate the challenge and, you know, I feel like we're in that good place now. So Mike, as we wrap up, we have talked about several things. We've talked about the legal tech industry. We've talked about where investments have been in the last couple of decades and where it is actually now in 23. And really what investors want to see from and need to see from companies is true organic growth and how to make that happen. So is there anything else that you'd like to offer the audience as kind of a recap or advice or counsel to the Rising Phoenix audience?
No, I think we've covered a lot, and you know, it's really, I think we're in a great time for our industry in that, yes, there are disruptions. You do need to have a generative AI strategy. You know, you do need to, if you're burning cash right now, you need to stop burning cash. If you're cash flow positive, it's really about growth. And, there's a lot of resources available to entrepreneurs in our space that weren't available even, you know, 10 years ago. High net worth individuals that are looking to place bets in this space, family offices, every type of institutional investor that's out there. So if you have a good idea and, are willing to put in some elbow grease, this is a terrific market to create wealth in.
Thank you. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining me. This is my first inaugural Rising Phoenix interview, and I couldn't imagine getting this series kicked off with anybody else but you. And I'm tickled that you joined me today. Thank you to our audience for joining us. I hope that you've enjoyed our interview with our guest, Mike Bryant, partner at Knox Capital. My name is Melissa Rogozinski. I am the CEO and founder of RPC Strategies, home of the Dream Team. Please connect with RPC Strategies on LinkedIn and sign up for our newsletter. You can also contact us at rpc@rpcgrowthstrategies.com or 205-873-1234.